Enquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Section 8, Part 2, and Section 9. Section 8, Liberty and Necessity, Part 2. There is no method of reasoning more common, yet none more blamable, than to try to refute a philosophical hypothesis by claiming that its consequences are dangerous to religion and morality. When an opinion leads to absurdities, it's certainly false. But an opinion is not false just because its consequences are dangerous. That line of argument ought, therefore, to be avoided, because it doesn't contribute to the discovery of truth, but merely makes one's antagonist personally odious. I offer this as a general observation, without claiming to draw any advantage from it. I frankly submit my views to the dangerousness test, and shall venture to affirm that the doctrines of necessity and of liberty that I have presented are not only consistent with morality, but are absolutely essential to its support. Necessity can be defined either as the constant conjunction of similar objects, or as the inference of the understanding from one object to another. Now it has silently been agreed, in the universities, in the pulpit, and in common life, that the will of man is subject to necessity in each of these meanings, which in fact are basically the same. Nobody has ever said that we cannot draw inferences concerning human actions, or that those inferences are not based on the experienced union of similar actions with similar motives, inclinations, and circumstances. There are only two ways in which someone might disagree about this. He might refuse to call this property of human actions necessity. But as long as the meaning is understood, I hope the word can do no harm. Or he might maintain that we could find in the operations of matter something more than the constant conjunction and the inference that I equate with necessity. But it must be admitted that such a discovery, because it concerns only the material world, cannot imply anything for morality or religion, whatever it may mean for natural science or metaphysics. I may have been mistaken in asserting that there is no idea of any other necessity or connection in the actions of body, apart from constant conjunction and inference, but what I have ascribed to the mind's actions is surely only what everyone does and must accept. My views about material objects and causes do conflict somewhat with what is generally believed, but my views about the will do not. So my doctrine can at least claim to be utterly innocent. All laws are founded on rewards and punishments, which are based on assuming, as a fundamental principle, that rewards and punishments have a regular and uniform influence on the mind, producing good actions and preventing evil ones. This influence must be regarded as a cause, and as being an instance of the kind of necessity that I have been presenting. The only proper object of hatred or vengeance is a person or creature that thinks and is conscious. And when any criminal or injurious actions arouse that passion, it is only by their connection to the person whose actions they are. Actions are by their very nature temporary and perishing. And if they don't come from some cause in the character and disposition of the person who performed them, they can neither bring him credit, if they are good, or discredit, if they are bad. Even if the actions themselves are blamable, even if they are contrary to all the rules of morality and religion, the person isn't responsible for them, and can't possibly be the object of punishment or vengeance on account of them. Why? Because they didn't come from anything in him that is durable and constant as his character is, or leave behind in him anything durable and constant. So according to the principle that denies necessity, and consequently denies causes in human behaviour, a man who has committed the most dreadful crime is as pure and untainted as a newborn baby. His character is in no way involved in his actions, since they aren't caused by it, and the wickedness of the actions can never be used as a proof of the depravity of the character. Men are not blamed for actions that they perform ignorantly and casually, whatever their consequences are. Why is this, if not because the spur to such an action is only momentary, ending when the action ends? Men are less blamed for actions that they perform hastily and without premeditation than for ones that come from deliberation. Why is this, if not because a rash or hasty cast of mind, even if it is a constant cause or force in the mind, operates only at intervals and doesn't infect the whole character? Repentance wipes off every crime, if it is accompanied by a reform of life and manners. What can account for this, if not the thesis that actions make a person criminal only in so far as they show that he has criminal drives in the mind, and when these drives change through his repentance, his actions no longer show what they used to show, and so they cease to be criminal? But it's only upon the doctrine of the necessity of human actions that they ever did show anything about his mind, so without that doctrine they show nothing, and consequently were never criminal. It is equally easy to prove, by the same arguments, that liberty, understood according to my definition, in which all men agree, is also essential to morality, and that in the absence of such liberty, no human actions are capable of having any moral qualities, or can be the objects either of approval or disapproval. For actions are objects of our moral sentiment only in so far as they indicate the internal character, passions, and affections, so they can't possibly attract either praise or blame when they come not from those sources, but only from external force. I can foresee other objections to my theory about necessity and liberty. For instance, this may be said: if voluntary actions fall under the same laws as the operations of matter, then every single volition of every human creature belongs to a continuous chain of necessary causes, started by the original cause of everything. No contingency anywhere in the universe, no indifference, no liberty. When we act, we at the same time are acted on. The ultimate author of all our volitions is God, who first set this immense machine in motion, and placed everything in it in a particular position, so that every subsequent event had to occur as it did, through an inevitable necessity. Human actions, therefore, cannot be morally wicked when they come inevitably from so good a cause. Or if there is anything wrong in them, God must share the guilt, because he is the ultimate cause and author of our actions. A man who sets off an explosion is responsible for all the explosion's consequences, whether the fuse he employs is long or short. And in the same way, when a continuous chain of necessary causes is fixed, whoever produces the first item in the chain is equally the author of all the rest, however long the chain is, and he must both bear the blame and win the praise that belong to them. And this holds whether the being in question is finite or, like God, infinite. Our clear and unalterable ideas of morality give us unquestionable reasons for applying this rule when considering the consequences of any human action, and these reasons must be even stronger when applied to the volitions and intentions of an infinitely wise and powerful being such as God. When it concerns such a limited a creature as man, we may plead ignorance or impotence in his defence, but God doesn't have those imperfections. He foresaw, he ordained, he intended all those actions of men that we so rashly judge to be criminal. So we have to conclude either that those actions are not criminal, or that God, and not man, is accountable for them. But each of these positions is absurd and impious, so it follows that the doctrine from which they are deduced can't possibly be true, because it is open to all the same objections. If a doctrine necessarily implies something that is absurd, the doctrine itself is absurd, in the same way that an action that necessarily and inevitably leads to a criminal action is itself criminal. This objection consists of two parts, which I shall examine separately. Firstly, if human actions can be traced up by a necessary chain to God, they can never be criminal, because of the infinite perfection of the being from whom they are derived, a being who can intend only what is altogether good and praiseworthy. Secondly, if they are criminal, we must conclude that God isn't perfect after all, and must accept that he is the ultimate author of guilt and moral wickedness in all his creatures. The answer to the first objection seems obvious and convincing. There are many philosophers who, after carefully surveying all the phenomena of nature, conclude that the whole universe, considered as one system, is at every moment ordered with perfect benevolence, and that eventually all created beings will enjoy the greatest possible happiness, not tainted by any positive or absolute ill and misery. Here is how they reconcile this with the existence of physical ills, such as earthquakes, plagues, and so on. Every physical ill, they say, is an essential part of this benevolent system, and could not possibly be removed, even by God himself, considered as a wise agent, without letting in some greater ill, or excluding some greater good. From this theory, some philosophers, including the ancient Stoics, derived a theme of comfort under all afflictions, teaching their pupils that the ills they were suffering were really goods to the universe, and that if we could grasp the system of nature as a whole, we would find that every event was an object of joy and exultation. But though this theme is high-minded and superficially attractive, it was soon found in practice to be weak and ineffectual. You would surely irritate, rather than comfort, a man racked by the pains of gout, by preaching to him the rightness of the general laws that produced the poison fluids in his body, and led them through the proper canals to the sinews and nerves, where they now arouse such acute torments. These grasping the whole views of nature may briefly please the imagination of a theorizing man who is secure and at ease, but they can't stay for long in his mind, even when he isn't disturbed by the emotions of pain or passion. Still less can they stay there when attacked by such powerful antagonists as pain and passion. Our feelings aren't affected by surveys of the entire universe. They take a narrower and more natural view of things, and, in a manner more suitable for the infirmity of human minds, attend only to nearby beings, and respond to events according as they appear good or ill to us. It can't reasonably be supposed that the grasping the whole considerations, that have so little effect with regard to physical ills, will have a more powerful influence with regard to moral ills. The mind of man is so formed by nature that when it encounters certain characters, dispositions, and actions, it immediately feels the sentiment of approval or blame. The characters that arouse our approval are mainly those that contribute to the peace and security of human society. And the ones that arouse blame are chiefly those that tend to public detriment and disturbance. This makes it reasonable to suppose that the moral sentiments arise, either immediately or indirectly, from a reflection on the opposing interests of public welfare and public harm. Philosophical meditations may suggest that everything is right with regard to the whole system, that the qualities that disturb society are in the main as beneficial and as suitable to the primary intention of nature as are those that more directly promote society's happiness and welfare. But what of it? Can such remote and uncertain speculations counterbalance the sentiments arising from the natural and immediate view of the actual state of affairs? When a man is robbed of a considerable sum of money, will his vexation over his loss be lessened in the slightest by these lofty reflections about the good of the whole? Clearly not. Why then should his moral resentment against the crime be supposed to be incompatible with those reflections? Indeed, why shouldn't the acknowledgement of a real distinction between vice and virtue be consistent with all philosophical systems, as is the acknowledgement of a real distinction between personal beauty and ugliness? Both these distinctions are grounded in the natural sentiments of the human mind, and these sentiments can't be controlled or altered by any philosophical theory or speculation whatsoever. The second objection can't be answered so easily or satisfactorily. It isn't possible to explain clearly how God can be the ultimate cause of all the actions of men, without being the author of sin and moral wickedness. These are mysteries which mere natural reason, not assisted by divine revelation, is unfit to handle. And whatever system reason embraces, it must find itself at every step involved in inextricable difficulties and even contradictions. It has so far been found to be beyond the powers of philosophy to reconcile the indifference and contingency of human actions, so that men could have acted differently from how they did act, with God's foreknowledge of them, or to defend God's absolute decrees, and yet clear him of the accusation that he is the author of sin. It will be a good thing if these difficulties make philosophy aware of its rashness, in prying into these sublime mysteries, and get it to leave this scene, which is so full of obscurities and perplexities, and return with appropriate modesty to its proper domain, which is the examination of common life. It will find there difficulties enough to keep it busy, without launching into such a boundless ocean of doubt, uncertainty, and contradiction. Section 9. The Reason of Animals. All our reasonings about matters of fact are based on a sort of analogy, which leads us to expect from any cause the same outcome that we have seen arise from similar causes in the past. Where the causes are entirely alike, the analogy is perfect, and the inference drawn from it is regarded as certain and conclusive. Nobody who sees a piece of iron has the faintest doubt that it will have weight, and that its parts will hold together, like every other specimen of iron he has observed. But when the objects are not exactly alike, the analogy is less perfect, and the inference is less conclusive, though still it has some force in proportion to how alike the causes are. Observations about the anatomy of one species of animal are by this kind of reasoning extended to all animals, when the circulation of the blood, for instance, is clearly shown to occur in one creature, for example, a frog or a fish, that creates a strong presumption that blood circulates in all animals. This analogical kind of reasoning can be carried further, even into the kind of philosophy I am now presenting. Any theory by which we explain the operations of the understanding, or the origin and connection of the passions, in man, will acquire additional authority, if we find that the same theory is needed to explain the same phenomena in all other animals. I shall submit to this test my hypothesis regarding our reasonings from experience, and I hope that this new point of view, looking at the use animals make of what they learn from experience, will serve to confirm everything I've been saying. First, it seems evident that animals, like men, learn many things from experience, and infer that the same outcomes will always follow from the same causes. By this principle, they become acquainted with the more obvious properties of external objects, and gradually store up a lifetime's stock of knowledge of the nature of fire, water, earth, stones, heights, depths, etc., and of the effects that result from the operation of these. The ignorance and inexperience of the young are here plainly distinguishable from the cunning and cleverness of the old, who have learned by long observation to avoid what has hurt them in the past, and to pursue what gave them ease or pleasure. A horse that has been accustomed to the hunt comes to know what height he can leap, and will never attempt what exceeds his force and ability. An old greyhound will leave the more tiring part of the chase to the younger dogs, and will position himself so as to meet the hare when she doubles back. And the conjectures he forms on this occasion are based purely on his observation and experience. This is still more evident from the effects of discipline and education on animals who, by the proper application of rewards and punishments, can be taught any course of action, even one contrary to their natural instincts and propensities. Isn't it experience that makes a dog fear pain when you threaten him or lift up the whip to beat him? Isn't it experience that makes him answer to his name, making him infer from that arbitrary sound that you mean him rather than any of his fellows, and that when you pronounce it in a certain way, you intend to call him? In all these cases, we see that the animal infers some fact beyond what immediately strikes his senses, and that this inference is entirely based on past experience with the animal expecting from the present object the same consequences that it has always found to result from similar objects. Secondly, this inference of the animals can't possibly be based on any process of argument or reasoning, through which he concludes that similar outcomes must follow similar objects, and that the course of nature will always be regular in its operations. If there is anything in any arguments of this nature, they are surely too abstruse to be known by such imperfect understandings as those of animals, for it may well require the utmost care and attention of a philosophical genius to discover and observe them. So animals aren't guided in these inferences by reasoning, nor are children, nor are most people in their ordinary actions and conclusions, nor even are philosophers and scientists, who in all the practical aspects of life are mostly like the common people, and are governed by the same maxims. Forgetting men and animals from past experience to expectations for the future, nature must have provided some other means than reasoning, some more easily available and usable device. An operation of such immense importance in life, as that of inferring effects from causes, couldn't be trusted to the uncertain process of reasoning and argumentation. And even if you doubt this, with regard to men, it seems to be unquestionably right with regard to animals. And once a conclusion is firmly established for them, all the rules of analogy tell us that it ought to be confidently accepted as holding universally. When an object strikes an animal's senses, it is custom alone that gets it to infer the object's usual attendant, and carries its imagination to conceiving the attendant in the special manner that we call belief. No other explanation can be given of this operation in all classes of sensitive beings, higher as well as lower, that fall under our notice and observation. But though animals get much of their knowledge from observation, many parts of it were provided by nature from the outset. These bits of knowledge far outstrip the abilities the animals possess on ordinary occasions, and in respect of them the animals make little or no improvement through practice and experience. We call these instincts, and we are apt to wonder at them as something very extraordinary, something that can't be explained by anything available to us. But our wonder will perhaps cease or diminish when we consider that the reasoning from experience which we share with the beasts, and on which the whole conduct of life depends, is itself nothing but a sort of instinct or mechanical power that acts in us without our knowing it, and in its chief operations isn't directed by any relations of ideas that we could deal with intellectually. Between flame and pain, for instance, there is no relation that the intellect can engage, no comparison of ideas that might enter into a logical argument. An instinct teaches a bird with great exactness how to incubate its eggs, and to manage and organize its nest. An instinct teaches a man to avoid the fire. They are different instincts, but they are equally instincts. Since all reasoning concerning facts or causes is derived merely from custom, how does it come about that men reason so much better than animals do, and that one man reasons so much better than another? Hasn't the same custom the same influence on all? I'll try here to explain briefly the great difference in human understandings. Then it will be easy to see the reason for the difference between men and animals. One man may greatly surpass another in attention and memory, in the largeness of his mind, and thus his ability to take in a whole system of objects and events, in how long a chain of consequences he can manage, in how free he is from confusion in his ideas, in how sharp and accurate he is in identifying causally irrelevant features of a situation, in how skilful he is in forming general maxims from particular observations, in how knowledgeable or intelligent he is in suggesting analogies, how free he is from bias arising from prejudice, education, passion, party, etc., or in how much he has learned from books and conversation. It would be easy to discover many other circumstances that make a difference in the understandings of men. End of section 9.